can survive if I let you.
Conquering nevermore.
Let the new era begin. The era of the ECW.
Oh my god.
Greetings, fans, and welcome to This is Extreme, an ECW history podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us for another episode. On this week's episode, we have guest Matt Radico, who directed the ECW TV show from 1993 to 1994. It's a fascinating conversation we had. It's loaded with great stories from someone who doesn't always get the recognition that they deserve for their impact. So we're glad you're here. We're glad you're listening. And get to hear this great, great interview from Matt Radico. Before we get there, let's take care of a couple little news clips. First off, Shane Douglas has a new podcast called Franchise University. It is available on YouTube and other guest and podcast platforms. As we all know, Shane's a great storyteller, great talker. So go check that out. Speaking of podcasts, Joel Gertner, on his 69-minute Eargasm podcast, has started talking about ECW events. I'm not sure how this fits into his format of things, if this is a once-a-month thing, once-every-so-often thing. I'm not sure how he's formatting this, but these are kind of long-form discussions on set ECW events, etc. And really, really interesting, really good stuff. So go check that out from Joel Gertner. Speaking of YouTube, we mentioned earlier, Francine, who we all know is the Queen of Extreme, is on a mission to get to 10,000 subscribers on YouTube. So go to YouTube, look up the Queen of Extreme, and subscribe to her channel. Help Francine get to 10,000 subscribers. While you're there, make sure you listen and check out her videos, her shorts. She has some great stuff, great guests, always entertaining the work she's doing. I just came across recently a book on Amazon, and I ordered it, and it's pretty cool. So check it out. It's called What the World Was Watching, Extreme Championship Wrestling in 1995 by Logan Sisko. It kind of takes 1995, goes into it in depth, talking about all the events, title changes, storylines, everything. It's a pretty fun book if you're kind of detailed, oriented like that, and information oriented. I like it. It's a pretty cool thing. It's a pretty cool reference book to have on hand. So check that out on Amazon. It's fairly inexpensive, I believe. I don't believe it costs a whole lot. And I got my copy in. I'm impressed by it. I like it. So go check that out. Again, it's called What the World Was Watching, Extreme Championship Wrestling in 1995, written by Logan Sisko. So that's all we've got this week. This episode, for news and etc. So let's pause for just a moment. And when we come back, we will have that interview with Matt Radico.
Be sure to follow This is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback, so find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution.
All right, and we're back on This is Extreme, and I'm being joined by Matt Radico, who is the director of ECW TV from 1993 to late 1994. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Dave, pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, I like, you know, when you do a wrestling podcast, it's easy to talk to our wrestlers and write and get their stories. I like to dig a little deeper and find guys, some behind-the-scenes guys, some guys in roles that people, fans aren't aware of, right? And, you know, people throw out a lot of names with ECW, but Matt Radico is not one of them, right? But you were there in a very integral part of those early days of ECW.
Well, you might be surprised. I probably get 4 or 5 times a year, someone reaches out on LinkedIn or on Facebook and says, are you Maddie in the house? And I'm like, because of my, I'm on IMDb with some of these credits. And yeah. I'm like, no, I was not just behind the scenes. I was way, way behind the scenes.
Different Matt.
it certainly was. Yeah.
He's a character. He was fun. So tell us how then, what were you doing around the time when you started directing ECW TV?
So let me first say that, you know, TV, small time TV, you could say direct, but I was producing, directing. I was on camera. I was running microphones. I was setting up chairs. I was selling tickets. I would do what, whatever I had to do to help Todd and the crew out to get this thing off the ground. So to answer your question, what I was doing is I own a small video production company. We had an office in Paoli, Pennsylvania. We worked mostly on local TV commercials for the local pizza shops and car dealers. And I was just really getting my business off the ground at that time.
Yeah. And from what I've read, you were a wrestling fan, correct?
I was indeed. I was as a child, but in the years, strangely enough, right around the time I got married, I found that I was home on Saturday mornings, and I started watching mostly WWF on Saturday mornings, and I was really captivated by it.
Yeah. So did you start going to some of those early ECW shows in the bars and stuff?
I was at a lot of them. I was not there as a spectator. So there was a gentleman by the name of Joel Goodhart, and I'm sure right. his name has come up with you guys before.
Yeah.
And not only did he was the promoter of something called the TWA, but he had a Saturday morning radio show on the local sports talk station
right. yep.
and that I would tune into all the time. And I'm listening to it, and these people are calling in, and they are so into it. And I said, well, maybe there's an opportunity here. So I actually reached out to Joel Goodhart. I think I probably called a neighbor of mine, Bob Ortiz, who might have connected me with Joel.
Of course, who did the ring announcing, right?
He was, and he's yep. still a neighbor of mine in my hometown. So I reached out, we went and met, and we had all these grand plans. And one Saturday morning, I'm listening to Joel Goodhart on the radio, and he says, "I'm shutting it all down." I'm yep. like, oh, well, what was I just spending all this time with you on? So that's kind of the genesis of it.
Yeah. So then how did you meet Todd then?
So I was unaware that it had started up again. I was actually reading one of the magazines, Wrestling World or one of those. And they used to have a little block in there that said, the rankings for, the top 10 rankings and all these indie promotions. And I saw something called the ECW. I said, what's this? And I realized it was Philly. So once again, I think I reached out to Bob Ortiz, who connected me with Todd.
I gotcha. So did you shoot right from the beginning? I mean, that there was an unaired pilot, correct? That was shot.
We actually started out at the sports bar, Mike Schmidt Sports Bar. And we just showed up with one camera and just taped all the matches just to have them. And we did that four or five times after that in some of these small venues. Just to have it, and things started to grow from there.
Yeah, and like you said earlier, I mean, ECW was a small company, and it was kind of all hands on, pitching in, and everything else. In your role, so what all you mentioned a few things earlier, but so what all did you do at these shows?
So in the very early days, we would show up with one camera and a boom microphone and no lights, and just record everything that went on.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. So it was all done like there in the bar and the venue, right? I mean, just promos at ringside. Everything was done right there, right?
We weren't even doing promos for the most part then. We were just taping the matches when we first started out.
Yeah. And so how did you get on Sports Channel Philly?
So we were taping these, and I had a contact who worked for a television network called Prism, which was sort of the big brother company to Sports Channel Philadelphia. They used to carry the Sixers and Flyers games at the time. And I said, Greg, who do you know over at Sports Channel? I got this idea to do a local pro wrestling show on there. And they connected me with the right person at Sports Channel. He was excited about it because it was local. And we would give them the show. They wouldn't have to pay us for it, for the content. They would take back, I think, 4 minutes an hour of advertising, which they used to promote the Flyers and the Sixers and that sort of thing, if I remember. So it started out very, with there wasn't a big aha moment to how that all started.
Yeah. And of course, then, in those days, television was the driving force to try to drive people to come to the live events. So do you remember when you guys switched over to what became known as the ECW Arena, the Bingo Hall?
So the actual, we actually did a pilot Because Sports Channel said we want to kind of see what this looks like.
Uh-huh.
So we were at the Kensington Rec Center. It was a rec center in North Philadelphia, I guess is the way you describe it. And we shot a pilot there, and there we did do some promos, and we did a live TV taping there, and we knew it was for TV. I guess that was sort of the proof of concept. And then Sports Channel gave us the green light for it. But we didn't have a venue to, right, to shoot it in. I don't think Kensington was available. And we actually started at a local college gymnasium. Was okay. The first place we did our first, I think, maybe 8-12 weeks of TV.
Yeah, it was. I mean, were you still just shooting one camera?
No, we were on to. We had so many technical problems the first time. I mean, I guess I had no idea what I was doing, or I thought I knew better than I was, but nothing worked that first night. The gym didn't have enough electricity, so we couldn't run all of our lights. And there was a power hum in the line. The electricity was dirty, so one of the cameras wouldn't even work. So we only had two cameras that we live switched at the event, the first night. Then we had a blizzard the next day, which really saved my bacon.
Yeah.
Because if I had to go back and deal with that again, it would have never happened.
Yeah.
When we went back 3 weeks later, Todd, bless his heart, trusted me to go ahead and do this again. And we shot 6 episodes in 2 nights, and it was fantastic. It was some of the best work we ever did.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, you had a little more room than those bars, right? A little more lighting, probably a little easier on your guys on the production side.
Right.
And you're running these shows. Do you remember when things booking wise started to switch it over from Eddie Gilbert to Paul Heyman?
I do remember. Eddie did, I guess, maybe the first 4 or 5 months of TV before he was out and Paul was in.
Yeah. Did you feel any impact from that style difference? I mean, did they give you a run sheet or anything for shooting?
Eddie was very organized. We would have pre-production meetings. In fact, the first time that we were taping, we had a pre-production meeting in his hotel room, and it was myself and Todd and Eddie and Bob, the ring announcer, was there. And I think someone from my crew was there. So it was like, this is the first match, and then this run-in is going to happen, and you know, we're going for 4 minutes here and 3 minutes, and everything that was like, wow, this is really organized. That was really great. Let's just say the style was much more spontaneous when Paul took over.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. That's what I've heard. I mean, Paul tended to fly by the seat of his pants a little bit, didn't he?
Yeah, and that really came through. I mean, it was frustrating as heck to try to do this, but the same kind of frantic, frenetic vibe that you had watching the show was because it really was real life. I mean, that really, really added to it. It came through on the screen.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. It probably conveyed over to an energy about the show, I mean, which it definitely had. I mean, and Paul was very hip on things too. I talked to Todd Gordon. He said he was enthralled how Paul always had his finger on the pulse of music and all these different things. And it was very weird. He said he didn't know how he kept up on this stuff. So also in those early days, talk to me about Jay Sully. Cause a lot of people don't talk about Jay a lot. Where did he come from, and how did he become the commentator on those early shows?
Jay is, I haven't seen Jay in probably 10, 12 years, but what a terrific guy. So Jay was one of those guys in the early days when I was just shooting these things at the sports bar with one camera. He was always around, and he was a big dude. He was bigger than half the wrestlers.
Yeah.
And he had this big voice, and I'm like, oh, this guy's put me on. It's like, no, that's really Jay's voice. He walks around like that. The ultimate wrestling fan. So when we got the go ahead from a Sports Channel to do the show, Todd said, I think Jay would be great. And I'm like, Todd, he's never done this before. You know, I think one time at a sports bar, he jumped on the microphone, and I don't even know that we used it on his voice on anything, because I recorded the voice separate from the action so we could have some flexibility. But, you know, he was like a big arm bar and big, everything was big, you know, a big right hand, a big boot to the face. Everything was big, but he was terrific, and he was really a Philly guy. So he really fit in with that. And some of that was, you know, a lot of us really didn't know what we were doing. So we kind of made it up as we went along. And Jay was a great example of that.
Yeah, there were some fun segments with him, particularly him and Eddie, that I remember when they started doing like the control center type thing. And that's where I really started hearing your name, because they would start like they were talking to you, and that you would move, you know, the camera would move like you were shaking your head and things. But
we just made it up as we went along. Yeah. They'd be talking and I'd be shaking, you know, one of us would shake the camera. So yeah, you're not wrong about that.
Yeah, but they were fun together. And he called all these matches with Stevie Wonderful. Now, was Stevie part of your crew? Because I heard he did some sound stuff.
He was not. He was he had a recording studio and recorded a lot of music. But no, he was a manager, for some of the guys when we first started, and then he did, you know, the color commentary in the early days too.
Yeah, he was a character, and it's funny, some of these guys that were on the early shows, and you know, you kind of forget they're there, because you know that's not the prime ECW years everybody thinks about.
Right. And Steve also, he wrote a lot of the original entrance music for the guys.
Ah,
so,
talented guy.
Yeah, he was, and you know, he would synthesize and all that. And it was, one more interesting layer that, you know, people had original music.
Yeah. And do you remember then when Joey Styles came in?
I sure do. I remember I pushed for Joey. I won't take credit for him, but I really, when we were sort of transitioning out of Jay Sully, we needed an announcer, and Joey showed up at a couple of the matches at the arena, the ECW arena, which was really a clubhouse for the Mummers. That I gave it the name. I feel like I'm bragging on myself. I'm the one who named it the ECW arena. It was Viking Hall it was called.
Yeah.
So I think I'm the first person to coin that. But he would show up and he had a headshot and he would give it to me. I'm like, Joe, I don't make the decisions, but he was, he wanted to be an announcer, but he wanted to be a heel announcer. You know, he didn't want to play it straight.
Yeah.
And he kept showing up and I'm like, Paul, you know, give him a try. He sounds like he knows what he's doing. You know, he went to school for broadcasting, give him a shot. And finally, Paul did.
Yeah. I remember one episode. He actually called with Jay Sully, and he did do kind of a heel thing. And I don't know if that was his tryout or what. It was awkward to hear him doing that, that heel thing. It felt weird.
You're right. Now that you're saying that, you know, it's I remember that he jumped in because we were still doing the play by play live at that time.
Yeah.
We were still doing it live during each match. Later on, we started to do it a different way.
Yeah. And then when Joey took over, I mean, Jay was still hanging around a little bit just on those segments. Like I said, he was just doing kind of that backstage interview role type for a little bit here and there and things. Right. So as they transitioned over, I was going to ask him, I can't remember what it was.
And part of the reason for that, Dave, is my office was in a little town called Paoli, Pennsylvania, and he lived 5 minutes away. And because things were so spontaneous, he's like, I want to do this locker room interview. And he lived 5 minutes away. So he would just get in his car and drive right over to my office and knock it out.
So those control center type shots, was that your office?
It was. If you're talking about what I think where you see editing, well, consoles and things
I had like a little monitor on the table and some things there. And
that was in this 600 square foot office, little tiny office.
Yeah. I always wondered what that was. And then one show I remember watching where Maddie in the House, which we mentioned earlier, ran out the door, and you could see it was some kind of street front type thing. I was like, well, what is this place?
Right. And some of it we did out in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. He had a Corvette, and I remember doing some bit with his Corvette one time.
Yeah. And it was funny you mentioned the name of the ECW arena earlier, because again, I don't know, these things jump in my mind as you're talking. I do remember one episode where it was called on a graphic for an upcoming show. It was called the ECW Dome. For like one time.
Really?
Yeah. And then the next week it was like called the arena. So I thought, well, I wonder what the switch was there. And I mean, obviously ECW arena rolls off the tongue a little better, but
that could be. Yeah. Dome is good too. I like dome.
Yeah. I don't know if you quite call that a dome.
No, you couldn't call it an arena either.
Well, that's true. That is true, I guess. But you know,
we only had regular chairs in there for the first couple months. And then somehow one day bleachers showed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as ECW kind of developed and became a little more, you know, hardcore, a little wilder, did that present new challenges for you filming and putting the TV show together?
Boy, it really was. So We were used to, you know, sort of that Memphis style where everything happened in and around the ring. And then they started brawling all over this building.
Yeah.
So we would have the ring beautifully lit, a little bit of spill light outside, so it didn't look like you were expecting it. But the rest of the building was dark. And they would start running around the rest of this place. And there were people everywhere. And one, it was hard to find where the action was. Two, it was really dark. Three, you could have like four or five skirmishes going on around this place. So it's like, where the heck do you put the camera? That's always, you know.
Yeah.
But that, did, that, as, that was, you, that was challenging for everyone.
Yeah. Did you get any cues for some of these real big spots? Because I remember like early on, like, I don't know, JT Smith jumping off a balcony or something. Did they give you any heads up that that shot was coming? Hey, don't, make sure you don't miss that or anything, or?
Yeah, we knew that was going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured they did.
Yeah, we knew that was going to happen. And we, that might've actually been Eddie's last show.
Yeah, probably was. Cause I believe
that might've been, yeah. Because the next week I remember cutting the show with Paul and he didn't want to show JT going all the way down. And I'm not sure why.
Huh.
But we never, in the replays, we only showed still frames of it, didn't show him going all the way down.
Yeah.
Not sure if we had it on one of the videos after the fact, but that's what we did.
Interesting. So what was some of the talent like to work with? Does anybody jump out to you?
Can I tell you one more thing?
Yeah.
That was, but before that, we had a scaffold match at one point.
Oh, yeah, right. I remember that.
Has that ever come up? Well, that was on a Saturday, and the scaffolding was supposed to get delivered on Friday. So I had to order the scaffolding. So I made it sound like, oh yeah, we're doing some, you know, lighting in the building. It's not, I didn't tell them what it was for.
Yeah.
Like 4 o'clock on the Friday, they got wind of what was going on and called me. So I'm out, you know, an hour from the city, and they say, Matt, we can't deliver that. We just found out what it's going to be used for. It's like, huh, what? What are you talking about? No, deliver it. And they're like, no, we can't do it. It says, you can come pick it up. I can't deliver it. So where am I going to find like an 18-foot truck at the last minute?
Yeah.
And the people who ran the arena, the Mummers guys, trying to think, I'll think of what his name was. Another really, really great guy down there, knew someone who had a construction truck, and we put it on the back of this pickup truck or big van or something like that. It was sticking out the back, and we got it down there and got it in place just in time.
That's hilarious. So are all the stories true that sometimes as your guys are running shows and whatever else, you had to rush out of the building because the bingo was coming in?
Yeah, the bingo started at like 11 or 12 at night. And I would have my crew break down everything, all our stuff. I didn't have to worry about the ring or the chairs, but they'd break down all the equipment, get it back into the production truck. But I'd be shooting promos or something else with the guys because they tried to get, you know, Terry Funks and the Snookas and the Road Warriors, whoever was there. That was the only time we had them to do their promos.
Yeah.
So we did like after the match, you know, locker room stuff in the back. So I'd walk out at literally at 12:30, you know, 12:30 midnight. And there'd be all these old ladies in there smoking cigarettes, eating donuts and playing bingo. It was like, what, wasn't there just death and destruction going on out here 2 hours ago? It was so surreal. You can't believe it.
I bet. So what was some of the talent like to work with? Who jumps out at you and what kind of stories you got?
So in the beginning, there were really two different groups. You had like the national guys that everyone knew that were kind of intimidating for me because I used to watch them on TV and worship them. And here I am.
Yeah.
So like, I never went near Jim Neidhart or, or Snuka was okay. He didn't talk very much, or guys like that. But the local guys, the local Philly guys, and then the local New York guys, they were all really terrific. They were all really nice. The nicest out of the lot of them was Jason. I think it's Jason Knight.
Uh-huh.
Jason the Knight. Sexiest man.
Yeah.
I haven't thought of these darn things in 30 years, Dave. So you're really giving me electroshock therapy.
Yeah.
He was such a gentleman, and he would always say, Matt, how many cameras do you have tonight? So if I look at that camera up there, and he would point to the stage, if I look at that you won't miss me when I show you my suit. And I'm like, no, Jason, that's perfect. Like, okay, thank you. He was just, you know, really nice. Tommy Dreamer, really, really nice guy. Pete Sinercha, Taz.
Yeah.
Super. Really, all they were always really Ted Petty and I can't think of Johnny Grunge's real name. Teddy and Johnny were always super nice, and
yeah,
they used to do the same thing where they would play off. They'd take their guy and hold his face up against the camera, and he'd say, "Radico, are you getting this? Radico, are you getting this in the truck?" And I'd say to the guys, I'd say, "Is he talking to me? I don't know." Yeah, it was a riot. So they were all terrific. Sandman, Hack.
Yeah.
Hack. He's another local guy.
Yeah.
Another good guy, him and his wife. They were nice. Nancy Sullivan was one. She was always super, super sweet to all of us.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I've always, you know, you always hear about how ECW was such a family, right? I mean, you hear that a lot in wrestling, but you really hear it there because these are guys that, you know, a lot of the big companies didn't want. And they went out, cut their own, you know, market and made their own niche. And you mentioned Jason, and a lot of people, they don't talk a lot about Jason, right? What he did. But I just saw the other day, Mikey Whipwreck tweeted or something saying how much in his early career, how important Jason was to teaching him things and helping him, and how nice a guy Jason was. And you don't hear a lot about that about Jason.
He was. And Mikey, did the story ever come up of how Mikey got started?
Well, I've heard some things. He was on the ring crew or something. Is that
he was, and you know, he was this real slight kid, and they just put the ring up, and it's maybe 2 hours before we start, and Joey Styles and I are standing out there talking, and these two kids are doing a match, and the one kid was good, but Mikey is like, I can't think of the words. He's bumping like crazy. You know, yeah. He's taking these flops and these hits, and we're looking at him and say, damn, this kid is good. So we went back and told Paul, you got to give this kid a chance. He is amazing. And he's like, yeah. And then I think maybe the next time he took a look at him and he put him in.
Yeah.
Joey and I really push for that kid.
Yeah. I love the early Mikey stuff where, you know, he just started off just, you know, getting beat by the guys, and then he would, you know, lucked in a couple wins here and there. It is the way they progressed him and how he was, you know, was afraid, said his mom was going to be mad at him and this and that. And that was great. I mean, that was perfect because he was such a young, meek looking guy.
He was. And I remember he had his first match that he won was, man, this is electroshock treatment. I'm really coming back with these memories. This guy called the Metal Maniac. I don't know if his name's ever come up. He was friends with Snuka.
Snuka, yeah.
They said, you know, Mikey's going to win this, and he says, "I got to put this kid over. No way." And it's like, no, but it'll be like by mistake. You know, he won't. You'll go out there and you'll kick the snot out of him. And I think the finish was like someone else came out and Mikey's arm flopped on top of the Metal Maniac, and that's how he won the match. But he was just terrific. He was so happy.
Yeah,
he was so happy that he got a chance to compete.
Yeah. So what's something that most people would be surprised about from behind the scenes of putting together a wrestling show like ECW? So give us a little peek behind the magic.
Yeah, it's and it's still to this day when I describe the work that we do, TV is kind of like an iceberg. You know, you only see like a little point above the water, but below the water, this thing is huge. So there were just so it took so much time to put these shows together. And I guess what people would be surprised about is that it would come together in such a random way. That it really was, each episode was created kind of spontaneously, you know, no real flow in mind.
Yeah.
Before we sat down to put this darn thing together. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm assuming with, you know, a small budget, small company, you had to use a lot of smoke and mirrors. I mean, I know there, you know, times like Public Enemy supposedly in jail and stuff. I'm assuming that's not really a jail. You know, I mean, you had to use a lot of smoke and mirrors and right. And where you shot and different angles and to try to make things look like what you're going for. And
it really was. So like you talk about Jay Sully doing, you know, a stand up in front of a locker room. That was a broom closet in this little office of mine that I was, you know, at a novelty store, and I found a sign that said dressing room. So I put the sign that said dressing room on there, you know, and it looked like it was the dressing room.
Yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah. Then I had to think about all the times when someone walked into that to get away, and I'm like, they're walking into a broom closet.
well, and you know what, that would actually happen when some of the guys who had never been there before, they walk in and they say, where's the dressing room? And I was like, oh, it's right over there in that corner. And they'd open it up and there was like a vacuum cleaner and the HVAC unit was sitting there.
That's funny. So are you still in touch with anybody from those days? You said you still live next door to Bob Ortiz, but
we live in the same hometown. I would see Bob once in a while. I'd see him in a supermarket, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to Jay in years. I was in touch with Joey on LinkedIn once in a while here and there.
Yeah.
But, I guess he's still, in Stanford.
I believe so. He kind of completely stepped away from wrestling.
Okay.
And just completely detached from it. You know, I think he just kind of, I don't know. I think there was some incidents with Joey and wrestling where he was just over it. And I don't think he has anything to do with it anymore. I don't think he's on social media or anything, and he's doing whatever he was doing, you know, in the real world.
And, okay. Yeah. I might have to reach out to him and say hello, but no, sadly, you know, I really lost my taste for the sport after I left. I was so burned out that, you know, I almost never watched wrestling on TV ever again after I stepped away from things.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, something that you like and you enjoy and it's a passion, but after a while, that hectic, it gets to be a burnout, and it's a burden. And
it really was. And we would literally work on that show for 48 hours straight from, you know, Saturday, Sunday, Monday afternoon, sleeping on the floor. And you know, I'm married, you know, and you know, I have the rest of my business to run, and it just got to be too much for me.
Yeah, is that why you stepped away? It was just too much. You had to just get some air.
It is, and that was a big part of it. But at the same time, I was working with some other folks on another really big project that turned into the company that I own right now. Okay. So I had some opportunities to do some work in the travel field of all things, which is the complete opposite of professional wrestling. But I had some opportunities. I was using the same equipment for the entire time. I was pushing it to its limit. I think at the end, a lot of it even stopped working. I didn't have the money to get things fixed.
Yeah.
So at the end I said, you know, this is a sign, guys, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'll continue shooting if you need me to, but I just can't do the post-production on it anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think I did that for a couple times and then that was it.
Yeah. So as you look back to your, you know, almost 2 years working with ECW and doing all this, what comes to mind? What immediately pops as your memories overall?
I really felt like I was part of something big when that was going on, part of something that was in pop culture. Yep. That even to this day, when people talk about wrestling, I say, you ever watch EC? Oh my God, I used to love that. I say, yeah, I was one of the people who started it. Get out of town.
Yeah.
And then I'll tell the stories and they're like, wow, you're not kidding. But it was really special. It felt when you walked into that arena, it felt like you were almost someplace illegal.
Yeah,
like there was something going on that wasn't supposed to be going on.
Yeah.
That you'd walk in and it was hot and the people were loud and swearing and throwing stuff. And, you know, I think my wife came one time and she says, I'm never coming back again. You know, it's like, I said, no, they're harmless. You know, it was like what we used to call the 700 level of Vet Stadium during an Eagles game. It was you know, the people who were the salt of Philadelphia coming out and letting loose.
Yeah. Did you have any interactions with some of the regular front row guys that have become kind of, you know, hat guy and all those guys that were
the hat guy? Oh my God. Yeah. The hat guy. Yeah. The hat guy. And we used to call him our biggest fan. It was this heavy set guy who used to sit up front. But then he lost all the weight and we couldn't call him our biggest fan anymore. Nice guys. And, you know, they would get there early and say, can you tell us when he's getting here? He's getting here. I was like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know,
I
didn't have a whole lot of interactions with them, but when I did, everyone was, you know, they just couldn't wait. If they were, this is something that they really wanted. And it was kind of cool to be part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. They were rabid. And they always say Philly fans are one of a kind. So,
well, they are. And this was, I don't think this could have started any place other than Philly.
Nope, I mean,
if you think about it, it's in South, this was a building in South Philly underneath I-95. It was dirty. It was hot. I mean, it was perfect.
Yep.
It really was. When you walked in there, you were ready for some action.
Yep. I've always said ECW, just the right place at the right time, that right area. It was, you know, magic in a bottle could never happen again.
It really was. And you know, a lot of credit to that goes to Todd Gordon, because
absolutely,
he really understood Philly.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a Philly sports fan, but he understood, and he knew that making it more extreme was what Philly people wanted.
Yeah. They always said, Todd and Hat got in some real deep discussions about Philly sports.
Todd and Hat, the front row guy. Really?
No. Hack. Satman.
Hack. Hack was a big sports fan. He used to ride around in his van around the neighborhood. he was good. He used to sometimes when we were stuck, because everything we did was on videotape, he would drive the physical videotapes of the episode up to Long Island where the satellite center was.
Wow.
And he was sort of a courier. And I'd say, Todd, I can't drive up there. I've been working for the last 2 days straight. I can't. He says, all right, I'll call Hack and he'll take it up there. Yeah, man, whatever you need, you know. And that's the way it was with all these guys, whatever you need. I mean, we were doing these house shows at a farmer's market out in the sticks, and I'd get there early and I would go and walk around the farmer's market on a Saturday and hustle tickets.
Yeah.
You know, I'd see a family and I'd say, oh, you know, we're doing pro wrestling tonight. I think I sold 40 tickets one time just walking around hustling.
Yeah. They always say everybody pitched in. I mean, Taz helped with merchandise and designing things. I mean, everybody did their part.
That's what it was. And then we had the videotapes toward the end. The videotapes were big sellers, especially when the Japanese tourists came in. One night there was a busload of Japanese tourists and they bought everything we had. I mean, If I had, you know, ECW toilet paper, they would have taken a roll of it with them. I mean, they had cash. They would just walk in and hand me $120 for 10 videotapes. I'm like, life is good.
Yeah, right.
Not bad work if you can get it.
Yeah, that's right. So before we get out here, is there anything you want to plug that you're doing now or anything you're working on or just kind of enjoying life right now?
Oh, I am enjoying life. I'm very fortunate. I'm married 33 years. I have a daughter in college. My company, VATV, just listed in the Philadelphia Business Journal as the 7th largest video production company in the Philadelphia area. So we're real proud about that.
Yeah.
We just opened up another television channel. We have several channels on the streaming platforms like Roku and Amazon, Apple TV. We just opened up another channel for Lancaster with some partners out there. So we're still working a lot in the travel and tourism business, and new technologies open up a lot of things for us.
Yeah, I bet. That's very cool. You still get to work in what your passion is all these years. I mean, where you started, and you're still doing it.
I do. Nothing makes me happier than walking into a room with a camera and figuring it out. And if I only got to do that every day, I'd be great. If I didn't have to deal with insurance companies and landlords and things like that.
Yeah.
Boy, it'd be so much better. Just do my thing.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thanks for joining me. Thanks for talking in. And thanks for your part in ECW. Like I said, it's everybody pitched in. Well, you know, you hear about Todd Gordon, you hear about Paul Heyman, you hear about the wrestlers, but there's a lot of other people that helped to shape this thing and where it went and what it became. So thank you for your part in that.
There really was, and everyone was so into it at the time. It was exhausting, but it was magical at the same time.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy yours today.
All right, and welcome back to This Is Extreme. Thank you, Matt Radico, for coming on and talking with us. We hope you enjoyed the interview. I thought it was a lot of fun, a lot of great stories, a lot of information there. Again, it's someone who doesn't always get the props, the spotlight that they deserve for their place in history and helping to develop and shape ECW and its direction. So thanks to Matt for coming on. Thank you for listening. And whatever platform you are listening on, please make sure you subscribe. And if possible, give us a rating and a review. That helps us in those algorithms for those podcast platforms. When people are listening to other similar podcasts, we come up in that suggested listen category. So that helps us out tremendously. Also, make sure you follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look up ECW Pod and we are there. Share lots of cool things, title changes, historical events, birthdays, all kinds of cool things on those social media platforms. So make sure you follow us and then make sure you share and help us spread and network our following. If you want to follow me personally, I'm on Twitter at The Dave Dynasty. And the best way to support us is that you can go and buy one of our shirts. We have a This Is Extreme shirt. Just go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and you can purchase one. Thank you for all your support. Thank you for following us, listening, etc., etc. We couldn't do it without you. We'll have a new episode out in 2 weeks. Thank you for being here this week. And until then, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.